Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is a very special first ever secret edition of the Distraction Pieces podcast. This is episode 47, and it's our first ever returning guest. It is the return of the one and only Mr. B. Dolan. Yeah, thank you all for tuning in. I kind of explained previously the point of the secretness of this was that I've really enjoyed... Obviously, we've got our secret T-shirt club, a Team 3W. You can buy the T-shirts. There'll be an ad somewhere in this podcast to tell you where to go, but we don't talk about it online. So it's a hidden thing for those who subscribe and for those who are just keeping an eye on the podcast. So I wanted to do an actual whole episode on that, and it seemed logical that today, Friday the 10th of July, obviously we're recording this in advance, but today, Friday the 10th of July, on my record label, Speech Development, a record, so I normally advertise at this point in the podcast, B. Dolan's album, Kill the Wolf, is coming out, and I thought it'd be good to get him on. We're recording it just over a week in advance of that. Get him on to kind of, and we'll talk about and tell you and give an insight to the ins and outs of how releasing a record work, how independent record labels work, how, I mean, the pressures of a campaign are leading up. I'm not going to lie, all of us involved in this campaign so far have felt a huge amount of pressure at points. Things haven't always gone exactly how we wanted. It's tough being an independent label, trying to push things out there. So that's going to be the kind of theme. Obviously, I normally have an advert here telling you to go to speechdevelopmentrecords.com and I recommend different things you should buy. Obviously, the only thing you should be buying today is B. Dolan's Kill the Wolf on CD or vinyl. I think we're a week and a half off at the moment. It's looking like the vinyl might be slightly delayed because there was a slight skip on the test press. I've not told B that yet. I might mention it in the podcast. So there might be a slight delay on that, but it's purely to get the highest quality product over to you guys. So yeah, there's that. There's also t-shirts, there's bundles, there's all sorts. So speechdevelopmentrecords.com, check us out. Yeah, that's kind of all I have to tell you before. So it's going to be great to talk to B. Oh, also I should mention, this is the first time I'm doing one over Skype, and if many of you are podcast listeners, you'll know that that can be the worst thing you hear in a podcast, because often the connections are terrible, the sound quality shit. So we're going out of our way to be a bit special with this. We're recording it, or we're talking over Skype, but I'm getting B to record into a microphone at his and me to record into a microphone here, so we can hopefully then put them two files together and we are good to go. So yeah, that's how this is working. Thank you very much for tuning in. I hope you all enjoyed the Doomtree ones on Wednesday, the Doomtree special with POS and Dessa. This, I think, is the first time we've done three in a week, so we're probably overpowering you and overloading you here, but thank you very much for supporting. But yeah, let's get the podcast underway. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces.
I press record. We're on.
I too have pressed record.
We're on the record now.
So we're on the record now. How you doing, B. Dolan?
I'm doing all right. How you doing, Scroobius Pip?
I'm good. I've explained at the start of this that we're doing some weird Skype thing where we're recording them separately. So we should probably do something so they can be lined up easy by Wargie. I know we don't like making his life easy, but should we do like a countdown together?
Yeah, okay. That sounds fun.
Starting at three?
Are we going 3, 2, 1, or are we going... Well, I guess that's the only way we'd be going.
You wouldn't go three, up from three.
4, 5, yeah. All right, so...
Three, two...
No, see, you're lagging behind me. Let's get it synced up, buddy.
Okay.
Three... What's happening? I'm alone. I'm alone, man. All right.
We're going together, I promise.
All right, here we go. Three, two, one.
That'll be enough. He'll be able to figure it out from that.
Yeah, figure it out, Wargie. Jesus.
So, yeah, this is the secret podcast that's coming out the day of release of your new album, Kill the Wolf, but we're recording it a week and a bit before.
Yeah.
So How stressed are you, B?
I'm pretty stressed. My blood pressure is at 20,000 as opposed to the normal 10,000.
Yeah.
Yeah. But no, it's good, man. I'm mostly excited.
Yeah, that's always good.
Yeah. My inbox and my text message queue is really overwhelming and horrifying at all times from the minute I wake up till the minute I close my eyes. But
yeah, it's interesting because this is probably the first time you've had a release that's being pushed, I don't know, actively in the UK. So
yeah.
Sadly, the time difference means that you're waking up with yeah. 10 emails from me, 10 from your booking agent, Rebecca,
yep.
and just you're having to wake up and go, all right, so
yeah.
a whole day's gone by again.
Yep.
How'd that happen?
Yeah, but I'm trying to keep in perspective, and I am excited that if the times I'm not answering emails has mostly been rehearsing.
Yeah,
And building the new live set. So that's been super exciting to like figure out how some of these things are going to work live and in the course of rehearsing be like, oh wow, this is going to be a cool, I can do this here. Like, you know, I've been sitting with these songs for 5 years, but I haven't messed with them as live things yet.
So yeah.
Yeah. They're kind of becoming new again, which is cool.
Well, let's talk about the fact it's been 5 years in the making.
Yeah.
How's that been, and how does it feel now for it to finally be out? I'd imagine that, in a way, adds extra pressure, but also the day after this podcast comes out, a massive relief that they're finally out there and it's finally in the ears of the public.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. This one was like a really big undertaking, and I do this to myself. Like I'm a fan of music first and for a long time, and I always had this knowledge that at a certain point, like, bands fall off, bands get yeah. like lazy, bands get, and so I'm always like policing myself for that shit, and the way I do it is to continually take on really ambitious things that I don't know how to do, and like, if I, you know, I kind of chase that feeling of like not knowing what the fuck I'm doing. And sometimes that gets me in situations where it takes me 5 years to put a fucking album together.
Yeah, that's stressful. But I mean, in the lyrics and in interviews and in our discussions, you've touched upon at times the necessity of points to go away for a bit. I think in rap, particularly the way mixtape culture is building up, people seem scared to go a month without releasing something. But at times, I think it's right that you and Sage have both said that sometimes you need to go away to come back, as you say.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And you know, as we've been busy in the going away time,
yeah.
we've been releasing stuff to keep people, you know, like, interested, or, you know, things that don't end up, because I'm just kind of continually making songs, so.
Yeah.
And some of those songs end up on an official album, and some of them end up on a mixtape for whatever reason, for sample clearance reasons, whatever. There's always kind of like a continual output of stuff, but yeah, it is, especially when it comes to an official album, I think it's important to show people something new when you are going to make this big a deal out of it. when you're gonna hire a publicist and make videos and do a world tour, like, that should be an important statement.
Yeah, completely. And to strengthen that, this is kind of the first time you've worked with full live instrumentation and really just being in the studio and building everything from scratch rather than messing with samples and whatnot.
Yeah, really, literally from scratch. I mean, there's some samples on the record, but even those samples we processed them in new ways. We, you know, ran break beats through preamps and mixers and stuff to get a new sound for them, and yeah, you know, EQ'd them in new ways and mixed them in new ways. And we actually, and part of the reason it took so long is we physically built a studio in the middle of making this album. Like,
amazing.
We moved out of one spot into the next, and like, I mean, like the sound engineers coming in and elevate, you know, separating walls from joists and shit and pouring cement and stuff. That was DS3K, the album's engineer.
Yeah.
But we literally built a lot of shit for this one.
I mean, that's insane, and it really highlights, because, again, when you say you're 5 years in the making, some people will think, oh, you've had kind of a chilled 5 years, but yes. It's great to get across that kind of thing of, as well as all the touring, all the promoting, all the other writing and recording, there's physically been the building of studios. And
yeah. Yeah, no, this is 5 years of work.
Literal blood, sweat, and tears going into this.
Yeah, yeah, it's not 6 months of work and like 4 years of off time. This is like 5 years of work.
Yeah. So, on this record, you did. I was reading a great interview you did on PassionVice.com, which is one of my favourite music sites. And it was interesting in there that you were saying about how on this album you stepped away from some of the... or you put more of the political stuff on the mixtapes so that they're more kind of just free and out there and can do what they want. And on this you've wanted to be more focused on hip-hop, on the craft. Still, there's still... political songs on there, but on telling your stories and honing the craft. What was the whole thought process behind all that?
I have struggled in the past with my feelings about political music to begin with. And what I have for the most part landed on is like, I don't want to make like bumper sticker rap songs where it's like you just kind of rattle off nice sounding political platitude shit that people can agree with and feel good about agreeing with. And then, you know, and so when I make political rap music, I tend to be very specific about it. I like to be specific about it because I think that if you know, songs like Film the Police give people practical advice in an entertaining way, and that can be impactful. That can actually make a difference as opposed to just being a kind of like feel good moment. So when I make political stuff, I tend it to be very pointed. Like, this is about Rick Ross and Iran-Contra. This is about Filming Police. This is, you know, but as soon as you make songs like that, you kind of also get pigeonholed. Like, people hear a song like that and they're like, oh, I know what he is. He's a political rapper.
Yeah.
And especially critics and all that shit. Like, I feel like it's a lazy thing that happens. Like, personally, I think that personal is political. I think that there's always politics, even in the, you know, minute human interactions between a husband and wife or between a brother and sister. Like,
yeah,
there's an elements of both things in each other. But in order to not give people the easy out of being like, oh, these are political songs, I kind of avoided that. I kind of kept the pointed political stuff on mixtapes, and it's such a gray area that I feel like it's hard to say there's no political content on the album, because there is.
Of course, yeah, definitely.
But it's more universal ideas, and it's more humanness, the humanness of these political things. Somebody's still going to call me a conscious rapper. It doesn't matter.
I mean, it's kind of good as well, because I think things like it shows, and I mean, just people who follow you on Facebook will know that you show regularly that you're it's genuine political belief or activism, rather than just, oh, I need to write a song and this will go off at the moment. And that kind of shows with songs like Film the Police and the Devil is Alive, because the fact is, they could have been huge bangers on your official albums, but they needed to go out at that time.
Yeah.
Like, they couldn't wait 5 years. You couldn't sit on that for 5 years, because the important stuff that needed to be said then. So in a way, I think from my perspective, it seemed like you overlooked potential personal career goals or how you could improve your own career from these songs, and just went with, right, no, this song needs to be written, you know?
Yeah, I'm a great guy.
You're a great guy. I had this for at the end of the thing, but how do you see the line between being an artist and promoting your shit and being a human that can't ignore what's going on in your country at the moment? Obviously, there's been a lot of, I mean, I love going through a few of your Facebook status is seeing the debates in there.
Oh, man.
And it's tough because on one level you're meant to be here to entertain stuff and do stuff, but on the reality is a lot of the shit that's been going on in America recently with the police acting completely inappropriately, and with, you know, kids taking up arms and going and shooting up black churches, it's stuff that needs to be addressed. And I don't know, I feel that can put, you're always at risk of putting a certain amount of your fan base off there.
Yeah.
So it's always has to be a bold and conscious choice to go, no, fuck you if you think this is acceptable or shouldn't be talked about, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I've kind of wrestled with politics and art for a long time, from before the time that people knew me. I was living in New York on September 11th, and at that time I was there trying to jump off my rap career. I moved to New York cuz all my favorite MCs were from there. And yeah. At that time, that was really like the break for me in a lot of ways. Like it changed me in a couple ways, and one of the important ways it changed me was that I suddenly like really felt that I needed to be involved in social justice work, and that there were like real emergencies going on in the world that I needed to not just, I was politically conscious at that time because of bands like Public Enemy, and you know, like I was writing about these things and reading about these things, but I something about like seeing the impact of, you know, world war in my city, like it like radicalized me, I guess you'd say, and kind of like made me want to get active. And I stopped performing at that time. Like when I came back to Providence, and when I met Sage Francis for the first time, I wasn't even trying to perform because I had kind of like already written off like, I'm going to make stuff, but I'm going to make it just for me. Like I had this encounter with Def Jam when I was in New York, and I had kind of decided that the music industry and that side of shit was not for me. Like I was like committed to this like dark, political, you know, uncomfortable work that I was making, and I just saw no way that that was ever going to sell. And I was like, all right, fuck it, like I'm going to be an activist. So when I met Sage, it was on some activist shit. I was trying to get him to help me with the youth poetry project that I was jumping off in Providence, and from that, just to he punked me off, and from that, just to show that I had skills and like I wasn't just some random dude, I started performing where they performed, and that's how I met and started, you know. And he, and touring with Sage kind of showed me like, oh no, there's this whole DIY circuit that exists. There's this whole scene for stuff like what you make, and you can have an impact making that stuff. You can do this as a career. So like I came into all this like again from a place where I was like, fuck it, like so yeah. That's the origin. So now, you know, it's just it's never changed. Like the in 2015 15 years later, you know what that means is like I don't need to sell tickets that badly that I want a racist or a homophobe at my show. Like I don't need to sell you a fucking CD. Like I would much rather you just stay home. And also when my career took off and I found myself with an audience in front of me, which were, because of the scene in independent hip hop, were predominantly white. I felt like, okay, like let's talk about whiteness, because I feel like it's the job of white people to talk to other white people about white privilege and white power and white violence. And I feel like it's the job of straight men to talk to other straight men about homophobia and those things. So, you know, I feel like, you know, the audience that's come to me it puts me in a unique position to talk to kids because I'm like them, but I'm also an ally with, Black Lives Matter and, you know, equal rights for LGBTQ people, you know. So, often my Facebook page turns into like a weird fucking workshop where where fans are talking to other fans about how they feel. And that's really cool. Like, I think
you made a great point there of something that gets overlooked a lot is a known saying now, and even becoming more and more relevant, that it's not enough to just not be racist. You have to speak to people in your community and all this kind of thing, because the fact is it's easier for someone to write off a black person telling them that Black Lives Matter.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Or for a white person to write off, because there may be a certain distance that they're already feeling, whereas someone who they can relate to and see as like them or familiar to them, then they're more likely to listen and pay attention and take that in and actually change or care about it, rather than have the gut instinct of arguing instantly because because you're saying something that's against their beliefs, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, and it also takes the burden off. It's like, you know, because people have this, like, entitled feeling, like, I got to talk to my black friends about this shit. Like, well, yeah. if like, you at all accept the premise that, like, your black friends are already dealing with, you know, white privilege, white power, white violence, they're already day-to-day encountering racism. Like, that's the last person that needs to spend 2 hours talking to you about why you are more afraid of black people. You know, like that. In addition to shouldering inequality, they shouldn't also have to be responsible for teaching your ass, you know, about their life, you know?
Yeah, yeah, completely. Well, I mean, And let's talk about a bit of what's been going on in America recently, because obviously there's been another huge tragedy with a mass killing, and it's brought a lot of people to even Obama for the first time to kind of talk about question marks over the gun laws. My stance on that is a weird one, because I stand in a country where we have obviously far stricter gun laws, and we don't have that kind of thing happening nearly as regular as America does. So my instinct is that America should tighten up their gun laws. Yeah. But with everything else that's been going on this year, I can't consciously stand here and tell a black man in America that they shouldn't be able to defend themselves, that they should just feel safe because guns are bad. It's like, well, one of the other problems is the police, and no matter how much you change your gun laws, they're going to have guns still. So I can understand that community, if you know what I mean, feeling the need for that. But it's a weird area. Where do you kind of sit on all that?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about Obama is it's not the first time he has like said that, you know, we need tighter gun control. He's said it multiple times, but it's just every time he says it, I sense less and more and more desperation with him.
Yeah,
like he says it, but there's no legislation proposed. There's no because it's we've already tried in the wake of mass shootings to propose that legislation, and it gets shot down. And so there's this weird kind of, I don't know, there's this weird kind of thing on the left where it's like after each time this happens, someone comes out and says, like, hey guys, you know, gun laws are fucked up. You know, this doesn't happen in other countries. And then we all go back to business as usual until it happens again. And then we act shocked and light candles when it happens. I definitely hear you. And I've heard, like, Killer Mike talking about his beliefs. And personally, man, I'm a gun owner. Like, I have a gun here. And so it is it's a very funny thing, and I imagine it's a hard thing to understand if you're not in the United States, because we do have this, like, tradition of owning guns. And I think it's, you know, in a way it's very antiquated and almost laughable now, because, like, our tradition of owning guns comes from the Second Amendment and the people's right to defend themselves against the government, which, you know, is part of, like, America being born out of revolution, and that constitution being written, you know, while the memory of having to resist a tyrannical government was, like, fresh in their minds. So they wanted to protect their ability to form militias and all that.
Yeah.
But, you know, what that means now, I just think it's one of those things that we haven't updated what it means. And we have now all these kind of fringe people who are also the most likely to be terrorists, like these, like, white right-wing males who are the most deadly terrorist cell, you know, like, operating in America at the time. And, you know, they've killed more people since 9/11 than any other terrorist group.
It's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's crazy. Yeah. Again, I think it got shared around a lot, but Jon Stewart had his monologue on it and was just saying exactly that. It's like, it's saying we'll do anything to defend our country against terrorists from outside of America, yet the biggest threat has now become our own. And we kind of go, yeah, but it's the Second Amendment. Is that right? It's like, well, all right, so you'll do absolutely anything. You'll condone, and many people do still condone, the torture and appalling treatments and stuff that went on because deep down they think, well, they're fucking terrorists, you know. It's not nice to hear, but they're terrorists. It needed to be done and all this kind of thing. Yet that goes completely out the window when it's like you can't have that gun in your cupboard anymore.
Yeah.
So, but I like having my gun in my cupboard.
Man, and the levels, like I've seen firsthand, you know, I have relatives and family that has, you know, gun safes. Like, you know, people have arsenals, like... And
one of the best lines on the album is of your cousin.
Yeah.
Do you want to share that line?
Yeah, my brother got a gun safe. That's a safe he bought to keep his gun safe.
Again, it's just and again it highlights the ludicrousness of what is a regular reality.
Yeah, and it, you know, it's one of those things too. And a lot of people said that, for example, like with Obamacare, a lot of people said that, you know, because there was a big call for single payer when that healthcare debate was happening in America, and what was said in response to that was like, well, yes, Europe has single payer, but Europe has a long history of single payer, and in America we have a long history of, you know, pay for it yourself in a privatized system. And so to, you know, you can't quite, we can't just go to single payer was Obama's actually take on it. And I feel like it's a similar thing where it's like, yes, in order to change our gun laws, we're going to have to go against hundreds and hundreds of years of existing tradition. But that doesn't mean it doesn't still need to be done. And we can at least take like incremental steps towards something a little more sane. Even if it's,
again, I completely agree. I think people get too hung up on, it'd be too big a change to make. And the only area I slightly disagree is I think it is possible to change completely. A Russia converted to communism and there was communism and democracy at the same time. They literally went overnight in the morning. Here's all the changes. And again, it got corrupted over time and things like that. But I think it's an illustration that shit can happen.
Yeah.
Obviously, that's probably not realistic in America at the moment, but it's not that black and white, a yes or no. As you're saying, there can be incremental changes. There can be improvements.
Yeah.
Even saying you can keep your gun, but you can't have automatic weapons, or there needs to be psych evaluations and things like that. Things in, surely that's a better route. And yeah, there's solutions there.
And also there's another line on the album that says like, I got a rifle but I ain't got drones. Like you know, when you think about the fact that like these laws exist so we could defend ourselves against the government, well, like, man, I don't give a shit what your arsenal looks like. You are not defending yourself against the United States government at this point in time. Like,
that's ridiculous.
And your home, you know, you and your fucking family might have a little compound where you can, you know, make a stand for 10 days. But like, if the U.S. government wants you gone, you're gone. No matter like where you are in the world, with the, you know, and like arguably, especially if you're in mainland America. So like, The shit doesn't even line up anymore, you know?
Yeah. It's just, that's a great point. I didn't really know that part of the amendment and the part that, that the illusion is that you're protecting yourself against the government when,
And
can't do that. That's being proven over and over again at the moment.
Yeah. But it's one of those things, man. It's like Mormonism. It's like a weird aberration that formed as a result of like this American experiment. now we just gotta like try and get that shit in check.
It's really strange, and the toughest part is the way that your government is run with the Congress and, you know, all the different kind of angles of it to get stuff cleared. Because now this is going to sound like a really insensitive comparison to gun law, but over here when we were bringing in the smoking ban, it was the biggest deal in the world. Everyone felt it was a huge infringement on rights, on if you choose to smoke in public place, blah blah. Within a month of it coming in, that died down so much, and I truly believe so much change of American gun law, it would be the biggest deal until you actually do it.
Yeah.
And then shortly after that, people would be like, yeah, cool. About stuff in advance that can be the biggest issue, and at points it's just a time to go, right, no, we can't talk about this anymore. And again, there's, if you can change it, then it can be changed back. So you know, I don't understand that resistance as a white British person living in a country that's never had guns. Obviously, yeah. I don't understand that resistance.
Yeah, it's tough, man. And it's tough because the people that, you know, it's like a cliche that people got very incensed about, that I think it was Obama during his first presidential campaign had some private comment about people being attached to their guns and their Bibles. And yeah. And that, you know, though the people in this country that are clinging to their guns the hardest are also the people that are, you know, in areas that are less educated, less, you know, like less poverty, you know, there's more poverty. They're basically like impoverished, poorly educated white people. Like, and that's stereotypical because, you know, there's gun owners all over the country. Like I said, I'm one. But in the areas where you find the most resistance, the areas where those people are going to fight those laws the hardest, and the areas where those people are going to turn into militias and often turn out to be terrorists are the, you know, like the stereotypical is the stereotypical shit. It's the reason that, you know, the Confederate flag is now like a big issue because like we see that flag in the South. We see, and 9 times out of 10, when you talk to that person with the Confederate flag on their truck, they've got a gun. And if you talk to them long enough, they're going to say some racist shit, you know, like, people say like it's a symbol of Southern pride, but it's bullshit, man. Like I've been around this country a lot and I've talked to a lot of people and you know, that, there's resistance and it's very armed resistance. So like, how are you going to go get those people's guns? Like, is you going to have a firefight every time that happens?
Completely. And there's a level of, again, it's not a simple thing. I'm completely understanding of that. Cause there's a level of if someone spent thousands of pounds on their gun collection legally, it's hard to turn around and say, right, you don't own that anymore.
Yeah.
You know, I understand there's levels of resistance and stuff that needs to be tweaked, but, I don't know. I think there's certainly a discussions to be had. I do want to get on to some touring stories and stuff like that. But before we do that, as we've mentioned Obama, do you think Obama is riding a fireball backwards, sticking two middle fingers up as he leaves as he leaves office? Because I think he is, and I think it's great at the moment. The fact I feel the biggest changes he's going to make are going to be in the last few months or whatever of his term. Because now it's like, well, I'm out of here now, so fuck you, gay marriage. Let's get rid of the Confederate flag. Let's do this and do that. Do you think that's kind of the vibe now that he's eventually going to kind of live up to the hype that he had coming in those last few months?
That's certainly the feeling, and that seems to be, you know, he's definitely had a hell of a, you know, this is traditionally known as like the lame duck session, where like he's got 2 years left, and the Republicans got control of the Congress, so the like conventional wisdom when that happened was like, well, this presidency is over. You know, it's been the opposite. He's actually started to do some of the shit that people have been, you know, hollering for him to do for the past 6 years. I think it's, you know, it's consistent with who he always was. I think that initial wave of like hope and excitement had a lot to do with who he was as a speaker. And who he was historically, like that historic change was exciting to people. But who he was in terms of policy and who he was as a senator was always, you know, was always a lot more like circumspect than a lot of his supporters. And I think that had a lot to do with like the initial, you know, disappointment around him. But you know, like I knew, you know, I was listening to what he was saying about shit, and I knew what to expect, and I knew that people still had to keep pressure on him all throughout his presidency. And that's the Democrats, really, like, but you know, he was like a constitutional scholar before he was a senator. So, and I think that's how he went about his presidency for the first 6 years, was very like, well, you know, like I'm not going to overstep my presidential authority. Like, you know, there's a process, there's a balance of power, you know, we're going to put these things to the Congress. And, you know, you have like this, you know, the Republicans, when they are not the majority, when they don't have the president, they are really good at putting, you know, bringing government to a halt and not letting shit happen. And that's what they did to him for about 6 years. And yeah, now it seems like he's like, all right, well, we tried the constitutional scholar route, so now we're going to go the like cowboy route. which is what people have been calling for him to do. But, you know, I understand the thought process, which is like, you don't want, when it was George Bush in office, you didn't want the president to be able to declare war without the Congress. You didn't want the president to be able to do, you know, and so in, you know, the method was like, well, you know, I'm going to respect the authorities of the president and not overreach them. But, you know, when it's on
again, I think it makes sense as well that, and again, I don't want to put too much a credit where it might be, but if he'd walked in and just started changing shit and going straight at it, there would have been so much resistance from all angles. Whereas spending some time making smaller, slower changes and winning people over, getting people on side within the Congress, within everything else, I'd imagine has made it easier for him to now make the changes he's making.
No, I think at the moment he's just bypassing the Congress.
Oh, right. Yeah. I mean, that's good too.
He's like, fuck y'all.
That works. Well, I mean, thankfully, and this is going to sound harsh now, but thankfully you get to leave America quite regularly. You've toured extensively over here, and kind of more so than anyone I know at your level of rap, if you know what I mean. Yeah. That, I think Americans... And it's similar. Like me and Dan, even at our peak, we've managed to tour America once properly. So the fact that you've been over numerous times shows a lot of love for over here. So I want to get on to some tour stories. But first, I want to read out your upcoming tour dates. You've got in America on July 11th. You've got the release show at the Met in Providence. Then on the 15th, you've got Kung Fu Necktie in Philadelphia. And on the 25th, you've got First Avenue with Sage in Minneapolis. Then you come to the UK in September, and you've got you're doing a spoken word set on my stage at Bestival, and then you're at the Rainbow in Birmingham on the 15th, the Deaf Institute in Manchester on the 16th, the Ferret in Preston on the 17th, Electric Circus in Edinburgh on the 18th, Stereo in Glasgow on the 19th, the Fleece in Bristol on the 21st, the Globe in Cardiff on the 22nd, XOYO in London on the 23rd, and the Haunt in Brighton on the 24th. But then also in October, you're going to Amsterdam, the Sugar Factory. October 3rd, you've got Pan Piper in Paris, a Molotow Bar in Hamburg on October 5th, Private Club in Berlin on October 6th, and Botanique on the 10th of October in Brussels, and more being added as we speak from what I'm seeing from my inbox.
Yeah, I just saw a Dublin show too. I think there's going to be some Irish dates announcing soon. And
I mean, that's sweet, because as soon as those dates were announced, the first voices up were Ireland, a lot of them were Ireland. And I mean, you've always had a lot of love in Ireland. I think the first place you ever stage dived was Belfast, right?
It was the first place I ever crowd surfed.
And you're not a small guy, no. So that was a hell of a moment and a hell of a show.
Yeah, man. The pictures of that are great, because I like all cool has evaporated from my face. I just have like this big dumb smile on my face, like I'm three. Like it's happening. It's happening for me. I never dreamed it would happen, but it is.
Yeah. That's beautiful. Well,
those kids in Belfast, and the kids underneath me looked like they were building a pyramid. Like they just had their heads down and their shoulders squared, you know?
I love it. Well, I mean, I want to get some tour stories in, but I don't want to be greedy and just focus on this side of the pond, because you've just had a massive tour with Atmosphere and you've been getting up with them and freestyling at the end of the sets.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about that. That sounds amazing.
Well, Slug kind of, he shamed me into freestyling again.
Like as you're trying to do with me at the moment, privately over messages.
Yeah, it's like a juice cleanse. Like I'm trying to get everybody into this shit now. The last time I was good at freestyling was like 2000, 2001. I was like, I dropped out of school. I was living with two dudes. One of them was trying to start a streetwear brand and the other was trying to MC. And so he would rap all the time. We were just listen to rap or rap 24 hours a day and also anywhere you went in that time, like you walked out of any poetry event or rap show and there was like a cypher on the sidewalk, it was hard not to freestyle at that time, because everyone was just doing the shit all the time. And by doing it all the time, you get good at it, and that's when it starts to be fun. And and I knew that, and I remember that time, but I just kind of fell out of practice over the years. And then, you know, Minneapolis MCs, they have like this like fixation / like deep appreciation for freestyling. I think it has to do with Idea.
Because
that's the dude that really elevated that shit. He like transcended on some you know, listening to that dude freestyle it gets more astonishing as you get better at freestyle.
Yeah,
you
completely. And he was one of the kings of Scribble Jam, which of course was, you know, came out of the atmosphere and, you know, the Minneapolis base there. So yeah, I guess that aspiration or that badge of achievement is going to naturally be heavy in that town.
Yeah, I attribute it to him. It's just a thing. Like when you're around Minneapolis MCs, man. I toured with Toki Wright and it was a similar. Like he was like, you know, we're just talking in the van. He's like, you know, at the end of the show, you want to all freestyle together? And I was like, ah, man, like I'm kind of rusty with the freestyle. Like, and he just looked at me like. He just gave me, like, it was in shade. It was kind of shade. Like, it was like, you're off your game, man. And I was just like, you know, I just played it off. Like, whatever. You know, I'm a good writer, you know. And the same thing with Slug. He, you know, like, we toured Europe in the fall, last fall. And he was like, yo, you want to get up and freestyle? And I was like, nah, man, I'm kind of rusty, And, you know, like, he left it alone. He wasn't, like, giving me shit or anything. But, like, we'd be walking around the city and he'd just start freestyling, like, prompting me to, and I was like, yeah, like, and so when I left that tour, I knew we were touring together in the spring, and I told him, like, I'm gonna have the freestyle ready by the time we tour in the spring. He was like, yeah. I was like, yeah. So for like 4 months, I knew that the only way to do it is to constantly do it. So I just, every time I was in the car, I had a beat CD and I would just listen to my own shitty freestyles for hours and hours and hours. Cause you suck for a long time. You just like, you have these like crutches you keep falling back on, or you say other people's lyrics, or you just fucking, you say your name 80 times.
You must know everything that B. Dolan rhymes with, like every syllable rhyme for every
keep going, every free flowing all the way across the deep ocean. Turn the bass up, let me feel the low end. Got a lot of meat in my colon. Hit the free throw and get the extra point. Anyway, but yeah. I got there, and by the time we toured together in the spring, the first night, he was like, he's like, you know, me and Dem are going to freestyle at the end of the set. I was like, I'll freestyle with you. He was like, yeah. And so it went off. It's fun, man. Now I'm at the point where, like, I've gotten to that point again where I can just kind of like listen to the words coming out of my mouth. Like almost like they're not passing the filter in the brain. They just come out and it's cool. And you say cool shit and you're like, oh damn, let me write that shit down. It's actually changed. I've been writing a lot of good shit that way, which is fun.
Cool.
Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously on one of the tracks on All Right, I believe it is, you reference a particular incident in Liverpool when you're on tour with us, where the power basically went.
Yeah, it's on Stay Inspired.
Stay Inspired. Sorry, man. My bad. I'm sorry. I fucked up. But that's right. I'm Stay Inspired. So talk about that.
Yeah, that was it happened. It's happened to me twice. The first time it happened when I was with you and we were in Hull, and it was the first.
Oh yeah,
it was the
first. That's when we recorded "Who Killed Russell Jones" originally, wasn't it?
Yeah, right. That's the video that we released. There is what happened when the power went out, and it was like the first. I've since learned why. As we've been like taking apart the set and putting it back together, Alias has this 808 kick drum sample he used a lot on Fallen House Sunken City. Yeah. And the name of that sample, we used it on the new record too. It's just this huge bass note that the name is just fuck.wave. That's the name of it. and it's that note that, like, when that note hits on certain systems, because now we're putting the set back together and we're looking at all the stems and taking everything apart and putting it back together, we realize that note has got some frequencies in it that will just blow the shit out of a lot of speakers. Like, they're, you know,
damn.
Yeah, and so it's that note. And so I think that's why on multiple occasions the first song of my set has caused a fuse to blow and the lights and sound to all shut off.
You found the venue system brown note. That's amazing that just found this. That just right, it's the kill switch now.
Yeah, fuck that wave. That's some Joker shit.
God damn. But the beauty of that is you've each time it's turned into a show highlight, right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, because when in that instance, the only thing to do, you know, once you're out there and like your set has started, yeah, I refuse to like just awkwardly give up the stage to anything. Like if someone comes on that stage, I'm gonna deal with them. If the fucking power goes out, I'm gonna deal with that. So yeah, I've just done spoken word. And in Hull, there was like 400 kids there. That was a big crowd, I remember. Yeah. And I was really having to like yell this shit. But that was one of the first times I ever performed Who Killed Russell Jones. And a photographer in the front row switched his camera into video mode and recorded it. And that is the video we released for Who Killed Russell Jones.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And the other time it happened was on a hardcore tour. We were the only hip-hop act on a bill with two hardcore bands. Yeah. And that, again, was like the second night of that tour. And we were in like North Carolina. And it was funny because like the first night was kind of a strange, like we were with these two hardcore bands and I could kind of sense them both looking at me like, how is this rapper going to deal with our audience? And the first night went well, but I could still feel like I was being sized up by the other bands. Like everyone was cool, yeah. But it was like, can these dudes really hang in our circuit? And that was the moment after that shit happened. Like everybody on the tour was like, God damn, man, that was really powerful. You know, like, cause a hardcore band can't do that. Not a lot of other performers can do that. And so, you know, just thinking about that and talking about that and laughing about that, I ended up writing a verse about it. Cause, It's a good metaphor for my fucking career up to this point.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I love the fact that you were on tour with hardcore bands and you're blowing the system when and with me and Dan as well. We had a big setup, but you were blowing the system with a backing CD essentially at that point. So let's discuss the many incarnations of your live show.
Yeah.
One of the things that impressed me about you and Sage early on, the first times I saw either of you, was you could turn up with a CDR
yeah.
and put on a full rap show and smash the shit out of it. But since then, I've seen you backed by NPCs, backed by DJs, and backed by a full band. So, yeah, talk me through some of the different pros and cons of that and what influences it. Obviously, there's often the logistics of the tour. If the venues are big enough and the fees are big enough, then you can do more. Yeah. If not, you've got to hold it down with what you've got. So tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, that's kind of what influences it. I personally, since I've been headlining and since I've been trying to establish what a B. Dolan show is like, separate from a Sage Francis show or an Atmosphere show or me opening for somebody else, since I've been doing that, I've been trying to bring the live band as often as I can. And if not the live band, then something bigger, something that fills the stage and takes up space and is, you know, sonically bigger than just a CD player.
You somehow managed to not go bankrupt when you bought like a 12-piece marching band over to the UK to back you. So
yeah, yeah, that was a good exercise.
You've tried a lot of variations.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm lucky to be surrounded by a lot of really talented artists. And so I always have like these ideas and these options. And it's just, sometimes it's just a numbers game of financially making it work. Sometimes but you know, I actually, when I toured with you, when I saw you, on the Distraction Pieces tour, what you were doing, that was like a huge, like, inspiration and led to a lot of the live band stuff we were doing. Cause I saw how you guys were doing, what you guys were doing with stems. Because for me, like, seeing hip hop with a live band, one of the draw, it wasn't always necessarily a selling point because I saw a lot of live bands where, it's the drums were my biggest problem with it was the fact that like it, you know, like you want to hear the specifically the James Brown, Clyde Stubblefield break when you hear Film the Police, and you want to hear like this 808 when you hear Earth Movers. And so hearing that played through one drum set, it just sounded like a rock band playing a version of a hip hop beat that I liked.
Completely so much hip hop over here. You'd get to a certain level and they'd have a that add a live band, and it would feel to me as if they've taken a step backwards, because just not having that same impact. It's not having that same effect. But what we decided to do was choose certain, like, have the band play into a click, so we can choose certain stems from the original record to still be there. So you're not just playing to a backing track, but you're adding that extra synth if you need it, that extra kick and everything else. So.
Yeah, and sometimes there's like really, sometimes it's like a noise like ah! That, like, it's really important to a fucking beat. And if you don't hear that noise, you don't feel like you're hearing the beat.
So
the stem stuff was really, like, once I saw that, I was like, oh, yeah, I like this. Like, this makes sense. So, and we developed something a little similar, but added this analog subfatty that plays the bass notes.
It's a beast.
It gives all this crazy punch and shit. But
I remember before the Speech of Element tour, you going on and on about bringing this synth over, and it was like, dude, is it really worth all the shipping and all this? And we were really behind your back. Me and Woolgie were like, dude, we can just recreate this. He's just bringing this specific thing that we're going to have to all relearn to use and not understand. And then when that first show in Bristol started and the whole room shook, the venue was on a boat and the boat almost sunk. And it was like, all right, no, yeah, it was worth shipping over. Yeah, I get it now.
Yeah, I've been backstage and like looked up at the like rigging and the shit and just seen like metal plates like just vibrating, you know, before I go out for the first song, and like I'm like, yeah, this is it. But yeah, and so now I'm kind of thinking of at the moment I've been now that I have that sound card that I had to purchase for the band that plays those stems. Now I've got it and I can do other stuff with it too. So me and Buddy Peace have been talking about developing a set that uses that sound card to sound as big as a band, but you know, like just still work out like a tight MC DJ set, which is something that we have yet to do. And Buddy has always really wanted to do. Like he's a fan of like those like Idea and Ability sets, or even, you know, older before that, like the Run DMC or Public Enemy or Jazzy Jeff and Fresh Prince type sets. And that's something that I think we're really going to try and do this year, me and Buddy Peace.
I'm so glad you put a Jeff and the Fresh Prince in there, because people ignore their legitimate part in hip hop because of the pop stuff that came after. But that's a legit a reference and influence right there.
Yeah, yeah. He's the DJ. I'm the rapper, I think. That was one of the first tapes I ever owned. That was probably my first hip hop tape.
Yeah, yeah. And it's dope.
Yeah, man.
It's no joke.
Yeah.
See, at what point do you decide what the setup of the tour is going to be? Is that a last minute thing? Because the beauty now is you've got so many variations of your show that there seems to be a lot of options.
Yeah, I've been working with DS3K, the same engineer that worked on the album, and he's the dude that put together the live band setup that we brought last time on the Speech Development Tour.
Yeah.
And
it's nice that you said that your idea for that live band setup was influenced by seeing the Distraction Pieces Tour, because you literally used my band. So it was a whole lot influenced by it. It was the same people playing it. I was like, no shit, that was influenced, really.
You weren't using them, shit.
Yeah, it's true.
But yeah, man. So since we put that together, it's now a thing that exists. It's like an Ableton setup that attached to a sound card. So as we're loading in all of these new songs into the set, which is exciting too. Like I'm excited to do sets that don't contain certain songs that I've been doing for a long time. You know, like do some of this new shit. And as we build it out, we're building it so that it can be played with a band, or it can be played with a DJ, or it can be played off a laptop, you know.
Awesome. That sounds dope. So, I mean, we're getting towards the end of the chat, but before we do, can we talk a little bit about, or explain a little bit, and me and Sage did this a bit when he was on, but explain a little bit the logistics of touring, of booking, of people buying tickets. And this comes in part from a post you did this morning that was kind of saying, look, those who have bought like early pre-sales do affect the whole tour, because it can affect the promoter's outlook on how much they're going to spend or put into it. It can affect literally the tour in you knowing how much budget you've got to potentially bring special things to special shows and so on and so forth. So, yeah, how closely do you watch the ticket sales and the pre-sales as they come through?
Yeah, I get updates every week from the booking agents on, you know, which cities are slow, which cities are going fast. Yeah, it's important, man. In general, man, it's important this year that if you've been fucking with us at any point in the past, like, that you fuck with us this year. And yeah, fucking with us means, like, sharing the videos, you know, checking out the album. I'm not saying you have to buy the shit, but I think people are going to dig it when it comes out. And if you do, then talk about it online, spread it around. And yeah, like, if, you know, get tickets to the fucking show in advance, it helps. It, you know, like, we are at this point just dealing with the music industry. Now that the album's done, now, you know, we have to get this monolithic industry to give a shit. And the way that happens is our fans have to be vocal. And, you know, and by doing that, you know, that's how you, you know, when you complain like, ah, good shit never comes to my city. You guys always skip whatever town, you know, like, this is where you can let people know that you want to see the show, that you want to see a big show, that, you know, this is how you get involved. And we don't do Kickstarters. We don't do Indiegogos. We don't do that shit for art. We just grind on the road and we tore our asses off and we, you know, I don't put out garbage to just pay my fucking rent with another bullshit mixtape. You know, like, I make sure everything I release is official and worth your money. So, you know, this is how, you know, I'm not doing no fucking, like, friends benefit pack, you know, like, I'm come rap in your living room. Like, this is the CD. This is how you support us.
It's great. I mean, I always really enjoy, for years I've enjoyed following Jean Grey on Twitter, because she's always very open and blunt about, look, don't come to me saying, oh, all the hip hop out there is shit, or there's no good music, or there's no... That's here now. It's like everything you're complaining about and waiting for and wanting, it's here now. So support it, or just accept defeat that the big things are going to be Iggy Azalea and things like that. You can't complain about that, but then not actively support when the exact thing you're asking for is coming about. And I do think it's tough though, from a fan's perspective, it's easier for us to know that. This is the record that you've been working on for 5 years. Yeah. This is what everything has been leading up to. And I can see that from a fan perspective, they've kind of seen stuff regularly coming up, either on YouTube or tours here and there or support slots. So it's a case of trying to get through that message, as you said then, that this is the one right now. Yeah. This is what it's been building to. This tour. I mean, this is the first time you've done a world tour, right? The first time you've done a tour that links in America, the UK, Europe. I'm seeing dates potentially being added in Finland, in Greece, and all sorts of crazy places. So that kind of illustrates how big a deal this is to you.
and that's why this is like this is the kind of the moment for me personally. Like, whereas before I've been out there in support of other people's projects, you know, my album has lined up with the release of somebody else's album, so we're touring together. But, you know, ultimately, like, if you want to see more Strange Famous in your area, if you want to see us more than once a year, then that means, like, go to the Sage Francis show and go to the B. Dolan show and go to the Scroobius Pip show. And at each of those shows, you're going to see dope openers, dope, you know, shit, and a different presentation of what we do. Or the shit's going to sink and it's just going to be like, well, you know, I'll be back whenever, you know what I mean? Like, whenever I can hop on someone's tour.
It's all just kind of informing on the real logistics of it. It's no kind of, A woe is me, if no one's there, I'm going to be sad. It's the fact that people hit us up constantly about come to this town or come to that town. It's like, you need to hit your promoters up about that, because we would love to, but it's not a logistic thing that we can look at every comment and then hunt through your local area and find out who that, and then approach them. Do you know what I mean? It's not how booking really works. So, yeah, it's one of them that if we come into your town, you need that support, and if not, then you're completely entitled to be pissed off about that,
yeah.
But not at us.
Right.
You know, there's people that you can get pissed off at and say, look, the venue up the road, there's no gigs going on half the time, or it's the same shit, it's pop commercial nonsense. You can get mad at them and hit them up, but yeah.
Yeah, and the other thing that's funny is when people hit us up and are like, when they see you're touring and they're like, bring Pip, or like, bring Buck 65. Like, that's something we constantly hear, because I feel like kids, like, they think that because one of us is coming, that A, we can practically manage to bring all the other rappers that we're associated with. And the reality of like how that would ever happen is like there would have to be demand in your town to see our shit, like they
insane, you know, demand.
And so my answer to that is like, no, you motherfucker, you bring your friends to my show. You bring eight motherfuckers that haven't come before to the show, make them fans, make their enough of a strange famous presence and a speech development presence in this city, and then we can look at, oh, now we got this. Now we're bringing a strange famous tour to Europe. You know, like now you can see all the rappers you like together, because this is just, the promoters just look at numbers. The booking agents just look at numbers. You know,
that's it. I mean, you, me, and Sage alone have talked numerous times about how dope it'd be to do a tour together. Have all of us out there.
That's
but
right, yeah.
The sad thing is, when we've looked into it logistically, it's tough, because essentially two of us will become on a support fee, if you know what
I mean.
You're gonna have to have one that's kind of getting the headline it's not like we get these fees and we're rolling in money. These fees go into touring. These fees go into putting on a show. It's not like it's as simple as splitting that, because then we need to get it all together. But yeah, anyway, that's kind of an enough about that. I think we've covered everything there. Have you got anything else you want to tell the people, B. Dolan?
Shit, what do I want to tell the people? All I got to tell the people is on the record. It's coming. Next week is going to be here. You're going to get to hear what we've been working on. And
what I love about this shit is so much of it, there's always, it's not like when I was growing up where it's right, I need to take a gamble on my investment here. The fact is, you've got a video on YouTube for Jailbreak of you, Buck 65 and Aesop Rock. You've got the All Right fan video. You've got Who Killed Russell Jones. There's kind of, people can go and sample this shit for free. And then if you're feeling it, all we would say is put your money in your pocket or your hand in your pocket and spend on that.
Yeah. And by the time this is out, the album will be streaming. I mean, you could probably just stream the shit on our SoundCloud and check it out.
Yeah,
but yeah, man, I stand by it for sure.
Well, perfect. Well, thank you very much, sir. It's been a pleasure talking. I'm hoping this works with all the Skype weirdness. But and congratulations on your album coming out after 5 years.
Yeah, and thank you for everything you've done to put it out, man. Like you know, you're going hard for it, and I love you for that, Pip. Speech development,
big love.
Yeah, eat that ass. Oh yeah.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Discretion Pieces.
There we go. That was Mr. B. Dolan on episode 47 that I said. I think it was 47. Great to chat with him. Actually, as we're at the end now, obviously I always ask you to subscribe and support and all that kind of thing. Subscribe on iTunes, rate, review if you can, tell your friends. But while we're here, I'll go through them dates once again. In America, he's at the Met for the release show on July 11th in Providence, Rhode Island. He's at Kung Fu Necktie in Philadelphia on the 15th, and then on the 25th at First Avenue in Minneapolis. Then he's doing spoken word at Bestival on the Isle of Wight on the 13th of September, and then on the 15th he's at the Rainbow in Birmingham, the 16th the Deaf Institute in Manchester, the 17th the Ferret in Preston, the 18th Electric Circus in Edinburgh, the 19th Stereo in Glasgow, the 21st the Fleece in Bristol, 22nd the Globe in Cardiff, 23rd XOYO in London. I can't wait for that. I love that venue, and Dolan in there is just gonna make it explode. And then the Haunt in Brighton on the 24th. I believe London, Brighton and Manchester, I think he said, are the ones that are selling best and closest to selling out. There's going to be some island dates added, hopefully in between the September shows, and then when he hits Europe on October 1st at the Sugar Factory in Amsterdam, October 3rd at the Pan Piper in Paris, October 5th at the Molotow Bar in Hamburg, October 6th at the Private Club in Berlin, and October 10th at the Botanique in Brussels, which is one of my favourite venues in the world. Yeah, check B. Dolan out on tour. I hope you've enjoyed this secret little special edition. It's secret that I've not spoken about it online, but if you want to tell your friends, I'm fine with you sharing it. Yeah, thank you for tuning in. We will be back next week with more of the Distraction Pieces podcast. I've been Scroobius Pip. You can hit me up at Scroobius Pip on Twitter, at Scroobius Pip on Instagram, or facebook.com/Scroobius Pip. Thank you and good night.
Yeah, this is B. Dolan doing a trailer for my new album, Kill the Wolf, out July 10th on Strange Famous Records and Speech Development. Kill the Wolf is the album that I've been working on for the past 5 fucking years. I can't believe it's finally finished, but it is. I don't know if I'll ever be able to... Jesus, cupcake. I produced the majority of the beats on the album that began in this room here as little scratch beats that I would make on my equipment and then take into the bigger project studio. Worked with DS3K, the engineer that built a fucking beautiful studio in the middle of the album. Synth lines I wrote here would get recorded on these big, beautiful analog synths that DS3K has.
Yeah, man, it's been a wild road. We programmed the live set for the cross-pollination tour with Circle Takes the Square. Had to stop touring, had to stop playing shows. Came home, built the studio, everything got stalled. By the time I got back, I was run down. Diabetes, celiac disease, lost 20 pounds. I've been crawling back to life at this point right now. Things are moving along now, got some momentum back. Feeling good.
I'm gambled here on Music Row with hustlers on the floors. And hell, I ain't afraid to roll in devilish dice.
We just brought in tons of people that I was excited to work with. Friends and people I met along the way in the past 5 years. Alias came down and tracked some synths with us. Buddy Peace lent some drums. Orpheus, Aesop Rock, Buck 65. Cecil Otter produced the opening track, Lazarus. There's this dude, Mike Brown, that plays upright bass. On the Kathleen Stublik of Circle Takes the Square, Dave Lamb of Brown Bird, a great Providence band, and a dude that sadly passed away. I was lucky enough to work with him on this project. Roz Raskin of Roz and the Rice Cakes, another exciting Providence band. Cupcake! Damn it! Daddy's trying to make a video! At the same time that this album is the most control I've ever had over the production of a record, it's also the most collaborative thing I've ever done. This is the manifesto after 5 years in the woodshed. People are finally gonna get to hear it. I'm pretty excited that I lived to see the day. This is as good as I can make an album. This is my best album, and it's as good as it fucking gets. So if you don't like this shit, you can just log off after this shit, because it don't get no better. Kill the Wolf. July 10th, Strange Famous Records, Speech Development. We coming for you! Ah!
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.